All right, gentlemen, we're going to leave it there. We're fresh out of time for tonight's show. Allow me to thank my guest, political analyst John Bosnich, joining us from Belgrade. Also, thanks to writer and political analyst John White, joining us from Edinburgh. And also, special thanks to you all for staying with us on Spotlight. It's good night for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, verses number 29 and 30, recited by Saeed Maliki.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. قل إن تخفوا ما في صدوركم أو تبدوه يعلمه الله ويعلم ما في السماوات وما في الأرض والله على كل شيء قدير يوم تجد كل نفس ما عملت من خير محضرا وما عملت من سوء تود لو أن بينها وبينه أمدا بعيدا ويحذركم الله نفسه
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, whether you hide what is in your heart or manifest it, Allah knows it, and He knows whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth, and Allah has power over all things. On the day that every soul shall find present what it has done of good and what it has done of evil, it shall wish that between it and that evil there were a long duration of time. And Allah makes you to be cautious of retribution from Himself, and Allah is compassionate to the servants.
This is IRIB English Radio.
The Taliban say they are waiting for the final nod from the U.S. to secure full control over the Kabul airport. This is Washington's warning of a threat in the area. Israeli warplanes attack the Gaza Strip, striking targets in central parts of the besieged Palestinian territory. Australian officials warning that hospitals will be overwhelmed in some areas in the near future amid a surge in coronavirus cases. Hey everyone, welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Good to have you with us. Now, beginning with Afghanistan, the Taliban saying they are gearing up for a swift takeover of the Kabul airport as U.S.-led foreign forces are pulling back from the country. A Taliban member says the group is waiting for the final nod from the U.S. to take full control of the airport. This is the group has rallied a team of technical experts and engineers to handle the airport's operation. The militants seized the African capital in mid-August following a lightning advance against the government. Since then, tens of thousands of Africans and foreigners have flown out of the country through the Kabul airport. On Thursday, two bomb blasts claimed by Daesh killed scores of people, including 13 U.S. troops outside the airport. The U.S. Embassy in Afghanistan has warned of a fresh threat near the airport. The complicated saga of the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan continues to unfold. Most recently, a bomb attack hit the crowd outside the Kabul International Airport, killing U.S. servicemen and Afghans. Scenes of death and confusion in Kabul have put the outcome of the 20-year war in Afghanistan in perspective, especially Washington's so-called war on terror.
On Thursday, the Afghan capital Kabul became the scene of carnage. Scores of people were killed after two bombs exploded in the crowd outside the international Kabul airport.
The Pentagon, however, stated there was only one bomb attack.
Over a dozen U.S. troops were confirmed to have been killed in the attack. The Daesh terror group claimed responsibility. The blast came as hundreds of people were rushing to leave the Afghan capital prior to the August 31st deadline set by U.S. President Joe Biden to fully withdraw troops from the country. Intelligence reports had warned about the possibility of attacks on the airport by an offshoot of the Daesh terrorist group, which has fought against both foreign forces and the Taliban in Afghanistan since its formation in 2015. The U.S. president vowed revenge on the perpetrators, saying the evacuation efforts will continue regardless.
For those who carried out this attack, as well as anyone who wishes America harm, know this: we will not forgive. We will not forget. We will hunt you down and make you pay.
Some, however, are questioning why the U.S. chose to withdraw from this Central Asian country at this point, and if it can continue its operations in Afghanistan without having a military base there.
I think that there are a couple of reasons. First of all, they might not have thought it was important. Secondly, they were probably preoccupied with getting out. Thirdly, I'm not sure that their intelligence is as good as they say. And I think that from their point of view, they had degraded Al-Qaeda to the point that they were satisfied with. They were not focused on Afghanistan.
The outcome of the United States' longest war has also raised questions about the success of foreign military presence in the country.
Now, both the West and Afghanistan have paid a heavy price for the invasion of the Central Asian country. Since the war began in 2001, over 38,000 civilians have been killed, including more than 2,400 U.S. military personnel. Now, the war has proved to be quite costly as well. Trillions of dollars spent in the meantime, and all that seems to have been for nothing, as the situation in the country is taking a turn to how it used to be before the invasion 20 years ago.
More than 111,000 people have been flown out of Afghanistan since the Taliban swept to power on August 15th. The Taliban had allowed U.S.-led forces to conduct the airlift while planning to finalize their own government as soon as the American troops left. U.S. forces are racing to complete their withdrawal from Afghanistan by an August 31st deadline set by President Biden. His administration is facing growing criticism over the situation in Afghanistan and what is seen as a hasty withdrawal after two decades of military presence. Biden, however, says the U.S. has long ago achieved its original rationale for invading Afghanistan in 2001, to root out the Al-Qaeda militants and prevent a repeat of the September 11 attacks on the United States. He has noted that the aim of the war has never been nation-building, a statement in contrast to what U.S. officials used to say when the war began.
But the fundamental issue is that in many, many cases, it's not only Afghanistan, it's been Syria, it's been Iraq, it has been countries in Africa. We've intervened in South America. Basically, without any willingness on the United States' part to recognize the sovereignty of other countries. So unless we begin to deal with that, I don't think we're going to be particularly effective in dealing with groups that we conceive to be terrorists.
Over the past 20 years, the U.S. and its NATO allies maintained a military presence in Afghanistan with the stated aim of fighting terrorists. The recent incident at the Kabul airport was a clear indication that the mission was not accomplished.
The top Iranian military commander says the United States failed to ensure security in Afghanistan despite huge sums of money it allocated to that country. Major General Mohammad Baghari said that the U.S. has spent more than $2 trillion on Afghanistan, including an annual $4 billion budget for the Afghan army, but to no avail. The chief of staff of Iran's armed forces added that the Afghan army was ostensibly equipped by the U.S. with efficient military hardware, but the army was too weak and failed to stand up to the Taliban. The general noted that the huge American funding failed to bring security and tranquility to Afghanistan, a country that's now facing conspiracies and threats. He said that the U.S. invaded Afghanistan, plundered its riches, and committed numerous crimes before leaving the country with a humiliating defeat. Israel has carried out fresh air strikes on the Gaza Strip, hitting a Palestinian training camp in the area. Three rockets targeted the center in two raids, no casualty or material damage. reported. Israel says that the air raids came in response to an earlier protest held in the southern city of Khan Yunis. The demonstration was held against the regime's continued blockade of the Gaza Strip. Israeli forces used live ammunition and tear gas to disperse peaceful rallies. At least 11 Palestinians were injured in the crackdown. In the meantime, Israeli warplanes have carried out fresh air raids under the siege Gaza Strip. We're joined by our Gaza correspondent a short while ago, and Ashraf Shannon. Provide us with some details on the strikes.
The location that was hit is a Hamas security post or a training center for Hamas's military wing, the Zin Qassam Brigades. Israeli fighter jets fired at least three rockets at that location. They hit it twice within the span of 10 to 15 minutes. They carried out two air raids attacking that place. This situation is been happening almost on a daily basis in Gaza. The Israeli regime says that the reason for the airstrikes is a retaliation for the peaceful protest that was taking place earlier tonight, as young Palestinians were protesting in the east of the enclave, throwing rocks and firing incendiary balloons in the east of the enclave, and specifically near the Shija'iya neighborhood, during which Israeli forces shot and wounded at least a dozen protesters, including children. Also earlier today, a 12-year-old boy succumbed to his wounds after being shot in the neck by Israeli forces during a peaceful protest last Saturday.
Amunat officials in Australia's New South Wales warning that hospitals will be overwhelmed in a matter of a few months given the rising number of COVID infections and related deaths.
For example, given the case numbers are where they are, I suspect in October we'll probably have the highest number that we do in intensive care. I suspect we've not reached the peak yet there at all. But how hard we work now will make sure we keep people out of hospital, and that's really important.
Now, the Premier urged people to get vaccinated and protect themselves. Her comments came as New South Wales reported a record number of 1,200 coronavirus infections on Sunday. There were also six more deaths. More than half of Australians have been in weeks-long lockdowns as officials struggling to curb the outbreak. Australia has so far reported more than 50,000 infections and nearly 1,000 deaths. In France, protests against the mandatory health pass keep going on. People oppose restrictive measures taken by the government to withhold the COVID virus. Our Paris correspondent has more.
The holiday season has ended, but the protests against the mandatory health pass are continuing. Only in Paris, three different marches took place, dozens all over France. The health pass is an electronic document that people have to show before entering public places. Medical figures show that in areas with more than 70% of people vaccinated, the transmission of the virus and the death qualities are very low. But many people continue to protest because they do not trust the government discourse.
I absolutely don't believe in what they say. We are facing dishonest people, liars. These people want to suppress our liberties and control us.
For me, there is something fishy going on here. I do not have any trust in this vaccine.
But medical figures seem to show the opposite. Today, end of August, 65% of the French population has received two jabs of the anti-COVID vaccine. The French health minister, Olivier Véran, himself a neurologist, administered an injection in front of the cameras. He said that people should fear the virus, not the vaccine. French officials say that the COVID crisis is getting under control thanks to the accelerated vaccination campaign and some mandatory measures. In French overseas territories, however, like Martinique, La Réunion or Guadeloupe, the situation is getting out of control because less than 30% of the people there are vaccinated. COVID infections and death casualties are high. Hospitals are full and the lockdown and curfew have been extended. Today, more than 90% of people who arrive in hospitals with severe symptoms of the COVID virus or who die from the virus are non-vaccinated persons. but the mistrust in the vaccine remains high.
Pour quelle raison?
Why do they force me to be injected with an unknown product, a pseudo-experimental vaccine? Normally, a vaccine is first tested on animals, then on volunteers. Today, the government threatens and blackmails an entire population. Restaurant workers and health personnel can be fired.
Hospital workers are now obliged to be vaccinated or have to show a negative PCR test. If not, they will be suspended without salary.
Most of the protesters do not deny that the vaccination campaign in France seems to be successful, but they would like the French government to use the method of persuasion rather than a restriction. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
Well, that was the COVID situation in Europe. Let's take a look at Latin America. Brazil has registered more than 24,000 new COVID infections in the past day. The health ministry confirmed some 680 more people dying of the virus. The country is the world's third worst hit in terms of COVID infections. It also has the world's second deadliest outbreak after the U.S. Meantime, Mexico has posted more than 17,000 new daily cases and some 760 fatalities. The figures raise the country's total confirmed cases to 3,328,000 and the overall death toll to nearly 258,000. Tens of thousands of people have staged rallies in the U.S. Capitol and dozens of other American cities to demand protections for voting rights. Demonstrations aim to pressure lawmakers to pass legislation to counter a wave of ballot restrictions in Republican-led states. Organizers say that the state-level moves to curb voting access disproportionately impact people of color. The protests were held on the anniversary of Martin Luther King Jr.'s historic 1963 march on Washington. After Democrat Joe Biden won the 2020 presidential election, Republican lawmakers in many states reined in the use of drop boxes and mail-in voting. Colin Campbell says that the U.S. conservative lawmakers are trying to prevent democratic changes in favor of the minorities.
Across the country, particularly in the Midwest and in the Southeast, you have many states that are passing restrictive voter laws. These things could include not being allowed to register on election day. So if you show up, you're maybe a young voter or maybe someone who hasn't voted in the past. If you wanted to register on that day to vote, you would be disallowed in doing so. There are other laws that are being passed in legislatures across the country that would not allow people to be fed in line. Now you're saying, well, that's kind of a weird legislation point, but because of the way that voting booths are set up, you have these long lines because of the access that voters do not have in certain states. There are only certain places where they can vote. So they go to these designated spots, which there are very few of within the population, within the state. They line up. It's in November in southern states. It can be very hot. People can be dehydrated. There are people that feed people in line so that they can last and stay healthy while they vote. Well, they're passing laws so that this is also disallowed. This is not a surprise when you have white conservatives or white hegemons who want to restrict the access to vote for minorities in the country because they see the changing demographic in the United States of America, where it was purely, where it was mostly white, and where white people had most of the power and the access to legislation and voting.
And tens of thousands of people are fleeing for safety in the U.S. state of Louisiana ahead of what officials warning is a life-threatening hurricane barreling toward the coastline. Hurricane Ida is expected to make landfall off the Gulf of Mexico on Sunday evening with winds as high as 220 kilometers per hour. That's a Category 4 storm. It could be more devastating than a Category 3 Hurricane Katrina that killed 1,800 people in New Orleans in 2005. Officials have issued evacuation orders for many areas in Louisiana. It's led to traffic jams on some highways. The state's governor warning the storm could be one of the most powerful to make impact in 150 years. The neighboring state of Mississippi has also declared a state of emergency. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hoped for nothing but bounty, and from whom I feared nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
In the limelight. A rapid Taliban takeover, a chaotic evacuation, and a deadly terror attack in Afghanistan have shaken confidence in the Commander-in-Chief and U.S. leadership. We're prepared for you an article written by David Smith. The piece is titled Biden's Worst Nightmare: How Afghanistan Shook a President. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. U.S. President Joe Biden bowed his head at the lectern, as if the weight of the world were on his shoulders. In his breast pocket was a card that keeps a tally of American service members who have died in Afghanistan and Iraq. Now he knew it would include people who died serving under him as Commander-in-Chief. Addressing the nation from the East Room of the White House, Joe Biden had just endured the bleakest day of his young presidency. In Kabul, a suicide bomber and gunman killed 13 U.S. troops and more than 100 Afghan civilians, two British nationals and the child of a British national. Like many presidents before him, Biden was required to move rapidly through emotional keys. There was compassion for the U.S. war dead, the so-called heroes who have been engaged in a dangerous, selfless mission to supposedly save the lives of others. Then a dark warning for terrorists reminiscent of former U.S. President George W. Bush. We will not forgive, we will not forget, we will hunt you down and make you pay. A day later, Biden ordered a drone strike in Afghanistan's Nangarhar province, which the Pentagon claimed killed two Daesh terrorists. In a statement on Saturday, 28th of August, Joe Biden said, "This strike was not the last." After half a century in national politics, Biden finds himself tested as never before. He came into office in January, identifying multiple crises, but did not mention Afghanistan in his inaugural address. The unforeseen catastrophe has diminished his standing at home and America's stature abroad. It was just last month that the president, implacably resolved to withdraw U.S. occupation forces by 31st of August, declared that the Taliban overrunning everything and owning the whole country is highly unlikely, only to watch impotently as the militants did just that, upending two decades of purported human rights gains in only 2 weeks. America's allies, who assumed that the defeat of Donald Trump would at least make America competent again, felt blindsided. The U.S. struck an uneasy truce with the Taliban and undertook what may prove the biggest airlift in history, evacuating more than 100,000 people from the crowded, chaotic Kabul airport. Then on Thursday, 26th of August, the Daesh terrorist group struck, inflicting the deadliest attack on U.S. occupying forces in Afghanistan in a decade and killing dozens of Afghans desperate to flee. As horrifying images flashed around the world, the White House sought to project calm. News of the attack broke as Joe Biden's national security team were in the Situation Room. When the president walked in, one of the first updates he received was about the atrocity in Kabul. Details came in through the day from commanders on the ground. Jens Psaki, the White House press secretary, told reporters on Thursday evening, 26th of August, "Any day where you lose service members may be the worst day of your presidency, and hopefully there's not more. But we're certainly early in the presidency at this point in time, so I would say he was somber and, as he said today, outraged at these terrorist takings the lives of service members." It was a day of raw emotion, unlike any other in the Biden White House. The Politico website reported, according to a person close to the Situation Room, during one staff meeting, sniffles could be heard at various staffers fought back tears when they learned of the American deaths. One White House official described the pace of the day's events as overwhelming. The 78-year-old president, whose own life is freighted with personal tragedies, would have been hit hard by the losses. Leon Panetta, a former CIA director and former defense secretary under President Barack Obama, can recall standing alongside then Vice President Joe Biden when America's war dead were flown home to Dover Air Force Base in Delaware. Leon Panetta said on Friday, 27th of August, "It was clear to me that he really felt deeply about the impact the loss of a loved one had on these families. I'm sure it's something that he's going to have to carry now for these next number of days as president. recognizing that the loss of life took place during his presidency. He added, "It had to be President Biden's worst nightmare to have lost that many U.S. service members in one blow, when his hope, I think, had always been to be able to bring our presence in Afghanistan to an end without losing another American. To have that happen, I'm sure, probably represented his worst day in office." For now, the frantic evacuation continues under constant threat of further attacks, racing to meet the deadline of 31st of August. There is little doubt some U.S. citizens and many thousands of Afghan allies will still be in the country after that date. Their fate remains deeply uncertain and could cast a lasting pall over Joe Biden's legacy. The debacle has drawn the harshest rebukes of his seven-month presidency, with some Republicans demanding his impeachment or resignation. Donald Trump called the retreat from Afghanistan the single greatest humiliation in our history. Congresswoman Elise Stefanik insisted that Joe Biden had blood on his hands. Democratic leaders have generally remained diplomatic, but some members of Congress have spoken out or at least urged an extension to the deadline. Seth Moulton, a U.S. Marine Corps veteran who made a surprise trip to Kabul airport in recent days, told New York Magazine, "The thing that everyone needs to understand, even if you completely agree with the Biden administration's decision to withdraw, the way they have handled this has been a total disaster. It will be measured in bodies, because a lot of people are dying because they can't get out." Other Western nations rapidly wound down evacuation efforts after the bombing. For allies, there is bitter disappointment. Joe Biden had been seen as a so-called steady hand who could restore U.S. leadership on the world stage. Scathing comments expressed at a recent session of the British Parliament made clear how faith in American hegemony has been shaken. Leon Panetta, co-founder of the Panetta Institute for Public Policy, said, "I don't think there's any question that when the picture of that chaos at the airport was shown around the world, it impacted on the credibility of the United States, particularly the sense that our allies, frankly, did not play much of a role in terms of the decision itself, and obviously were not part of the lot of strategizing that took place. I think he's got some work cut out for him to try to restore credibility, particularly with our allies." Yet, to the dismay of many, Joe Biden has dug in, given no inch, acknowledged no error, and shown no contrition. He claimed a deal struck by his predecessor, Donald Trump, with the Taliban, the U.S. occupation forces to leave by May, left him with only two choices, withdraw or escalate. The American public, exhausted by America's longest war, had no desire for the latter. Some observers have been puzzled that Joe Biden's much-vaunted empathy displayed for American troops has been less copious for Afghan women and girls now at the mercy of the Taliban, and that a man steeped in foreign policy has unapologetically prioritized American interests. Ivan Osnos, a Biden biographer, said, "The moment reflected a collision of two of his instincts. The total frustrated determination to act on 12 years of wanting out of Afghanistan, combined with a smaller C conservative calculation about America's interests. The fact is, and he would acknowledge this, that he thinks more about members of the American military than he does about Afghans who worked with Americans or for them. His compassion has limits." Biden's popularity has taken a hit, dipping below 50% for the first time in opinion polls. However, he is fortunate that the midterm elections that will decide the balance of power in Congress are still 15 months away, an eternity in political news cycles. it is far from certain that he will suffer long-term damage for ending a war that had become profoundly unpopular. Indeed, some Democratic strategists caution against a rush to judgment. Bob Shroom, director of the USC Dornsife Center for the Political Future, said, "There was obviously an intelligence failure which I don't think can be blamed on Biden. They've done as well as you possibly could under the most adverse circumstances imaginable." Bob Shroom added, "I mean, this will have been the most successful airlift of evacuees in the history of warfare, or maybe in history, period." He added, "All these people are prematurely saying, oh well, that's the end of Biden. That's totally ahistorical and fails to recognize that we've been through things like this before."
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
It's August 2021 and the Taliban has de facto taken over Afghanistan, establishing full territorial control after it was toppled in 2001 by American and NATO troops who invaded and occupied the country for almost 20 years. The United States' longest war in history has come in at a cost of over $2.2 trillion, with around 3,500 NATO troops killed, and more importantly, over 50,000 Afghan civilians killed, a conservative estimate, leaving millions others displaced and turned into refugees. So what was it all for, people ask? Why did the United States spend so much money and stay in Afghanistan for so long, only for the Taliban to retake the country so quickly and easily? Was it all for nothing? Well, very few seem to be asking what Afghans gained from this war and why they paid with their lives, their homes, and why people thought it was okay to colonize their country for 20 years. Was this really about nation building and fighting a war on terror? Or was it an occupation and a war of terror? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. Almost 20 years ago, following the events of September 11th in 2001, a cataclysmic chain of events was set into motion by the neoconservative administration of George Bush and Dick Cheney. The United States and its allies invaded Afghanistan under the pretext of capturing Osama bin Laden and toppling the Taliban, who they claimed had sheltered him and his terrorist organization, Al-Qaeda. Afghanistan quickly turned into a quagmire for American and NATO troops who were unable to catch bin Laden nor establish full territorial control over the rugged and rough terrain of the Central Asian country. And despite this, year after year, every American president since Bush, including Obama and Trump, kept the war going. The defense budget got increasingly bigger, and the arms manufacturers made bigger profits as they provided everything from boots to bullets to tanks and missiles. And all the while, the U.S. was able to maintain a military presence on China's borders, Iran's borders, and in close proximity to Russia. It's only until 2011 that Osama bin Laden was allegedly killed during a U.S. raid. And despite this, the U.S. continued occupying Afghanistan for another 10 years under the pretext of nation building. They argued that Afghanistan wasn't equipped to deal with any of the challenges that it faced and it needed help. NATO claimed to be training the Afghan security forces who were supposed to take over once they left, which would be on May 1st of 2021, as agreed by Donald Trump's administration and the Taliban in Doha last year. And so here we are. And what happened when NATO began to leave? Complete chaos. The supposedly 300,000-strong Afghan security forces that the U.S. claimed it had spent 20 years training and equipping suddenly vanished overnight. U.S. President Joe Biden blamed the entire collapse of the Afghan government and security forces on Afghans, and then had the audacity to claim that the U.S. should have never been in Afghanistan nation-building, after he supported the war on terror, the war on Iraq, and oversaw the occupation of Afghanistan as vice president under Obama. Ironically, on July 8th, Biden gave a speech ensuring there will be no humiliating withdrawal from Afghanistan or anything like what we saw in Saigon.
There's going to be no circumstance where you see people being lifted off the roof of an embassy of the United States from Afghanistan.
And of course, that's precisely what happened. The withdrawal was most definitely just like Saigon, if not worse. Just to give you an idea of how fast the Taliban was able to advance and gain territory, on July 9th, the Taliban held 90 districts. Meanwhile, the Afghan government and security forces held 141 districts, leaving 167 districts contested. 1 month later, on August 16th, and the Taliban now controls almost every single district in the country. In many instances, it even took back some cities like Jalalabad and provincial capitals without a fight. Images of people panicking and attempting to flee the advancing Taliban flooded the news. U.S. military planes took over Kabul International Airport, ferrying diplomats, military, and other people deemed worthy enough by the U.S. government of being airlifted out of the country. People were desperate to be evacuated. They were seen scaling the walls of Kabul's international airport, desperately trying to get out of the country. As one of the American planes was preparing to take off on the runway, people could be seen walking alongside it and even clinging onto the plane. A tragic video even showed some people falling to their deaths from the departing aircraft, and another person is reported to have later been found in the plane's landing gear. Again, a very tragic reminder of just who NATO prioritized and who it left behind when the chips were down. Now, a striking photograph was taken showing an American Chinook helicopter flying over the U.S. Embassy in Kabul. This immediately drew comparisons to the iconic photos that we saw taken in Vietnam in 1975, when people were being evacuated by helicopter from the rooftop of the U.S. Embassy as the People's Army of Vietnam advanced to take the city. Now, asked about these comparisons, a visibly irritated Secretary of State Antony Blinken rejected outright the similarities between the U.S. withdrawal in Kabul and 50 years prior in Saigon.
President Biden said that under no circumstance, and that was his word, those were his words, under no circumstance were the U.S. personnel, embassy personnel, be airlifted out of Kabul in a replay of the scenes that we saw in Saigon in 1975. So isn't that exactly what we're seeing now? I mean, even the images are evocative of what happened in Vietnam.
Let's take a step back. This is manifestly not Saigon.
And yet the mountains of photographic evidence suggest otherwise. Indeed, not just analogously, but tangibly and quite visibly, Biden's Saigon moment had come. Joining me on the program to talk about Afghanistan is Ray McGovern, who worked as a CIA analyst for 27 years. He prepared the president's daily brief for Ronald Reagan when Reagan was president. In 2006, McGovern returned his commendation medallion in protest over the CIA's torture program. And he's been a vocal critic and outspoken activist against war. He even publicly confronted Donald Rumsfeld for the Bush administration's lies on Iraq. On another occasion, he was severely beaten for turning his back in silent protest to then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. He's appeared on virtually every major news network, as well as numerous other radio, TV shows, and documentaries. In recent times, he's even grown his beard in solidarity with political prisoner and journalist Julian Assange. Thanks for coming on the program, Ray. It's great to have you. Just to start out, you know, why do you think the war in Afghanistan was such a failure? I mean, you recently wrote an article for antiwar.com discussing this, and you've offered several explanations. What are they, and why was this withdrawal compared to Saigon?
Well, the activities and the events speak for themselves. The only thing I would point out is that for one group, it was not a failure at all. It was a gravy train. The entity that I call the military, got a pencil, military industrial congressional intelligence media academia think tank complex. Now, what I say, what do I say media as in all caps? Well, the media is the linchpin here. You can't deceive the American people at large without being without capturing the media. The media, of course, is happy to be captured. And so you have what Dwight Eisenhower warned against 60 years ago now, the military-industrial complex on steroids. So these people made money hand over fist. I think the latest indications are that if you had stocks in Lockheed or Raytheon, your gains in this gainful period of, you know, over the last, 20 years, would be 58% higher than the norm of the gains. And, you know, that does not make me wish that I had invested in any of these war things. But it's very instructive, isn't it, how people profiteer on wars and the foot soldier dies or gets wounded.
So, you know, when we talk about the military-industrial complex, which, you know, you've eloquently expanded to include other fields, which are indeed complicit. I mean, what concretely made it such a gravy train?
Money. I mean, I just mentioned the appreciation of stocks. A lot of these generals went through the revolving door, you know. Even Austin. Defense Secretary Austin. Well, now, he was head of CENTCOM, the Central Command, which commands that area of the world, Afghanistan, Iraq, and the rest of it. And when he retired as CENTCOM commander, he was really unapologetic about what had just gone on. He testified before Congress just before he retired. And they asked him, now, General Austin, tell us, we invested $500,000, $500,000, in preparing and training good guys, moderate terrorists, to go into Syria and do our bidding. Yeah. How many are still in action? And he looked very stolidly and said, four or five. The next week, he joined Raytheon. Mm-hmm. Okay, he didn't wait a year. I think you're supposed to wait a year at least, maybe 2 years. He joined Raytheon, and then Biden picks him to be the defense secretary 4 years later. I mean, hello, is this a great country or what? So fast forward now to this past 3 weeks. Well, let's go back to when Biden said, we're getting out of Afghanistan, we're getting out of there, we're going to be out of there by 9/11, right? Okay, he said that in mid-April. So, I think it was the 14th of April, 2 months, April, May, June 14, General McKenzie, you know, head of CENTCOM, announced, we're pulling all our air support out of Afghanistan. We're not going to do any close air support anymore. And the only thing that would persuade me to reintroduce air support if there were an attack on our homeland or on the homelands of our allies. It's the only thing. Otherwise, we're out of there. 14th of June, right? 2 weeks later, the 1st or 2nd of July, in the middle of the night, the biggest air base ever, Bagram, is everybody gets out of town. in the cover of darkness without even letting...
In the middle of the night.
You know? Okay. So what's my point? My point is this. What did they expect? The only thing that was keeping the Afghan army in operation was the close air support. Anytime they were attacked by the Taliban, when they call in, and the U.S. would do their bidding. So here, on the 14th of June, the head of CENTCOM says, no, we're not going to do escort anymore. And then 2 weeks later, he makes good on that promise by taking all his troops as many planes as they could out of Bagram Air Force Base. Okay? So you're a Taliban, right? Or you're an Afghan army officer or province leader. And you say, you know, I think I'll switch sides. And, of course, there have been all kinds of deals being made for the previous years, actually. So they did switch sides. Taliban comes in, and before you know it, last Sunday, they control the whole country, or almost the whole country. They come into Kabul.
Yeah, and, you know, when we're talking about withdrawal, the troop numbers have fluctuated. As you said, it was 6,000. It was supposed to be 2,500 and go down. But, you know, regarding the CIA, what about the CIA? Because, as we know, the first people on the ground in Afghanistan in 2001 were CIA. They were paramilitaries. And we've heard no mention whether they're withdrawing. As a matter of fact, the CIA director Burns said back in April that they're not leaving. And, you know, that's not been covered anywhere in the media. And what about the private contractors? The contracts are still in place. So is it a real withdrawal or just a withdrawal of conventional armed forces?
Well, the Afghan Air Force, such as it is, can't possibly function without the contractors. Even the helicopters can't be kept in the air very long without spare parts and so forth. So the contractors will have to stay. Huh? You think that? Taliban's going to say, okay, you keep our helicopters going and you can stay? Well, maybe, because there are helicopters now, you know. I mean, hello. The whole thing is so sadly ludicrous. The fellows from the CIA that came in on those horses, remember that? All those pictures, they came in on the horses, and they were catering to the Northern Alliance, those warlords that are just worse than the Taliban, in my view. They're gone. I mean, the U.S. military took over. And one function of that, which is worth emphasizing, is that once the U.S. military takes over, once the U.S. military is at war, well, they do their own intelligence. Thank you very much. We don't need the CIA or DIA or anything else. We know what the battle requires, and so just as in Vietnam.
Do you think it's a coincidence that there's no negative coverage of the war, but there is negative coverage of the withdrawal?
No, I don't think that's a coincidence. You know, I have very few good things to say about the Washington Post. Actually, only one, and that is that almost 2 years ago, they printed Craig Whitlock's Afghanistan papers. My God. You don't need anything else to see the lying and the cheating and the profiteering and the avarice and the, you know, the hubris that characterized our top military and political figures. Now, this is documentary, okay? So if anybody listening or watching here, we want to know what's really going on. Just look up Craig Whitlock, the Afghanistan papers, and you'll see what a charade it was. Actually, not sure. Charade is nice. I mean, it was a war crime. What's going to happen, and lots of people died.
Yeah, I mean, people are focusing very much on the withdrawal and saying that it's been badly executed, it's botched. Do you think it would have been different, perhaps, had it been completed under Trump, since he agreed to this deal with the Taliban?
It's really hard to speculate on that kind of thing, but what did they expect to happen here? And so, you know, the next logical step, in my view, is did they do it deliberately? Did they want the biggest mess that possibly could occur by simply not doing the necessary planning? And boggles the mind to think they were so dumb, that they didn't get really with it.
So do you think it's this whole campaign has diminished the standing of the U.S. and its allies across the world as military powers, as nation builders, and so forth?
Well, it was avoidable, of course. It was perpetrated for the wrong reasons. Everything is obvious now, so certainly. You know, here's a specific. 6 days ago, on Sunday, there were three Luftwaffe, the German Air Force, okay?
Right.
Three great big Airbus-type things circling Kabul Airport. Now, those of you who have seen the videos saw these little dots all over the runways, and those were people. And so the Germans were circling around, They couldn't land because there were people there, and they didn't want to land on people, right? Okay, now, what does that say? They had to go back. They ran out of fuel. They had to go back to Uzbekistan, refuel and all that. Now, the German people know about that. German people don't know that a week before, some German aircraft took what was left of the beer and the spirits that were left in the embassy and other German compounds back to Germany. They repatriated the beer and the spirits.
Ray McGovern, thanks so much for coming on the program. It was great speaking with you.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
So while the United States claimed it had to invade Afghanistan in order to get rid of Al-Qaeda and those who harbored and sheltered it, who helped create Al-Qaeda in the first place? Was it not the U.S. who created Operation Cyclone with bin Laden and his mentor al-Zawahiri receiving assistance and money from the CIA in order to fight the Soviets? Is the U.S. not supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria right now, now known as HTS, which controls Idlib? Who armed these Salafi terrorists and turned a blind eye to Saudi Arabia's export of Wahhabism? The United States, and even Hillary Clinton, admits this on tape, that the U.S. helped create and fund Al-Qaeda, the same enemy that it claims to be fighting today.
I mean, let's remember here, the people we are fighting today, we funded 20 years ago. And we did it because we were locked in this struggle with the Soviet Union. They invaded Afghanistan, and we did not want to see them control Central Asia, and we went to work. And it was President Reagan, in partnership with the Congress, led by Democrats, who said, you know what, sounds like a pretty good idea. Let's deal with the ISI and the Pakistani military, and let's go recruit these Mujahideen, and let's get some to come from Saudi Arabia and other places, importing their Wahhabi brand of Islam, so that we can go beat the Soviet Union. And guess what? They retreated. They lost billions of dollars, and it led to the collapse of the Soviet Union. So there's a very strong argument, which is, wasn't a bad investment to end the Soviet Union, but let's be careful what we sow, because we will harvest.
So when the Americans and British say that they helped Afghanistan, why are so many people trying to flee then? Why have almost 20,000 people been evacuated in the span of 2 weeks? Was it helping Afghanistan when British and Australian special forces were executing unarmed Afghan men and then planting weapons on their bodies to frame them as terrorists? Was that helping Afghanistan when a video released in 2020 showed Australian SAS chasing an unarmed man, 26-year-old Dad Muhammad, and then executing him in cold blood? We covered these war crimes by Britain and Australia. Here I spoke to whistleblower David McBride, who's facing decades in prison because he helped expose these atrocities. Just a few weeks ago, Daniel Hale was sentenced to 45 months in prison after he blew the whistle on the U.S. drone program, showing, for example, how during a period of 5 months, 90% of the people killed were not even the intended targets. Julian Assange has been persecuted for a decade now and is facing up to 175 years in a U.S. prison because he published the Afghan War Diary, showing how the war was a giant failure in killing scores of civilians. Naturally, you see there's only negative coverage of the withdrawal, but no negative coverage of this war on terror, or should I say, war of terror. The media loves war. They want to keep people focused on this so-called botched withdrawal, so they don't remember the images of Abu Ghraib or Guantanamo Bay, or the kidnappings, the rendition, and torture. And even more absurd than George Bush and Tony Blair's justification for these wars are people now claiming the U.S. should invade and occupy Afghanistan in the name of women's rights, which they say could be threatened under the Taliban. Now, ironically, these same media liberals and fake anti-war people never say a word about women's rights in Saudi Arabia, a close U.S. ally. The only difference being, of course, that Saudi Arabia gives America enough oil for them to shut up and not care about women's rights. They continue to talk about what to do with Afghanistan and other countries as if they own these countries. They speak like this also about Iran, about Syria, about Iraq, Venezuela, Cuba. This is so indicative of their colonial mentality and worldview. They want to civilize other people because they think they know better. And they don't see other countries as independent sovereign nations that are inhabited by equals. No, they see them as colonies, as vassal states that must be conquered.